Income inequality, the shrinking middle class, the growing divide between rich and poor. Where is all this heading? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we ask what's driving the growing wealth inequality and how Iowa fits into the national picture. We also explore how this is heating up the current political mood and ask the question, are the pitchforks coming for the plutocrats? My guests, multi-billionaire entrepreneur Nick Hanauer. Also, sociologist David Peters and political scientist Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. Well, here's your chance to pose a question to a billionaire about wealth distribution in this country. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Major themes of this election cycle: income inequality, the shrinking middle class, we've been hearing a lot about that, the growing divide between rich and poor. This hour, we want to find out what's driving the growing inequality, how bad is it, and how does Iowa fit into the national picture? Is that even happening here in our state? We want to explore how this is feeding into the current political mood and ask questions such as, when has inequality looked like this at other times in U.S. history? Also, are the pitchforks coming for the plutocrats? That's in the title of an article. We'll talk to its author in just a moment. Nick Hanauer is with us. He's a multi-billion-dollar entrepreneur, and he'll be joining us in just a few minutes. So here's your chance to pose a question to a billionaire about wealth distribution in this country, or just ask a question about the political repercussions of wealth distribution and where you see all this heading. Joining us, first of all, David Peters is Associate Professor of Sociology at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Glad to be here.
Let's have you give us a snapshot of Iowa in the context of the nation, a picture of wealth distribution here. How does it look?
Well, it's a double story. So first off, Iowa has much lower rates of income inequality than the nation as a whole, but we are growing much more faster. So our rate of inequality growth is faster than the national average, so we're catching up. So Iowa is more equal than the rest of the country, but in the last 15, 16 years, we've been catching up to the rest of the United States, which is true also with our poverty rates.
Mm-hmm. So what is driving this catching up to the U.S., and what exactly are we catching up to in terms of wealth distribution?
Right. So the first answer to the question is what's driving it? And sociologists and economists and others that study this say that what the underlying process that's driving this is a shift away from an industrial economy that was generally regulated by government, which we call welfare capitalism, that was prominent from really the post-war era through the 1970s, to what we call a neoliberal or financial capitalism, where there's been a deregulation of the economy, a flow of capital across countries. And what that's done is it squeezed out those middle-skill, middle-wage jobs and replaced them with two large classes, the first being a very high-skill, high-wage professional managerial class on the one hand, and on the opposite end, a large number of relatively low-skill, low-wage jobs. So what's driving inequality is this hourglass job opportunity structure where there's fewer and fewer middle-skill, middle-wage jobs that were in abundance through most of the post-war period.
Mm-hmm. And why the lag in Iowa catching up on this sort of hourglass development?
Well, because we lag in terms of those kinds of professional industries that the global economy creates: finance, information technology, mm-hmm. advanced professional services. Really up until the 80s, Iowa was primarily a manufacturing and agricultural state. But as we progress through the 90s and 2000s and the 2010s, the financial sector, the insurance sector, even in farming, we do more and more in the services end of agriculture. Now, while farming and manufacturing are still important, those are a much smaller piece of our economic pie than they ever were in the past. And as a consequence, we see more of that inequality.
So give me an idea of some of the groups here in Iowa that are most affected by these trends. I guess you could put them into, in economic terms, the winners and the losers.
Sure. In terms of the losers, or what we call the bottom 20% of the income distribution, so the way we study this is we take population of the state and all the income, and we slice it into five equal pies or equal slices. So if we look at the bottom 20% of earning households, what we find is that bottom 20%, which is about a quarter million households in Iowa, they own about 3.9% of all the income in the state. So mm-hmm. that means that almost a quarter million of the households in Iowa only own less than 4% of the wealth. And that translates into a median household income of about $13,000 a year. So you have a quarter million households living on $13,000 a year.
Wow, that's a stark statistic.
It is. And that share of income has fallen by nearly 40% since 1980, and it's fell by 11% since 2000. So their small share of the economic pie, which was small to begin with, it's been increasingly shrinking as the decades have gone by. On the other hand, if we look at the top 20% earning households, those individuals, and that, again, is about 250,000 households, they own about 47% of all the income in the state. And they make, on average, about $160,000, $170,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. And when we compare that 4% of the bottom quarter million to the top million with nearly 50% of the wealth here in Iowa, that compares to similar numbers on a national scale. What are those?
Yeah, so in the national scale, the poorest 20% in Iowa own more of the income than nationally. Mm-hmm. So it's about 4% in Iowa for the bottom 20%. It's about 3% nationally.
Okay, so we're catching up on this, I guess, unenviable divide.
Exactly. And last thing I want to say is, even within that top 20%, if we look at the very top 5% of households, which is about 60,000 households in the state, they own 20% of the income, with a median household income of about $270,000 a year. So we have 60,000 households owning 20% of the income in the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Poverty, what about that specifically? How do we define it, and where has that number been going here in Iowa?
Yeah, poverty depends upon the income that a household has from all their sources relative to the number of people in the household. And so I believe for a single person, it's about $12,000 or $13,000. For a family of four, it's about $20,000, $25,000. Where those trends have headed in Iowa is really, since the 70s, we've had declining poverty rates, and it reached its bottom point, the lowest we've ever had, in the late 90s. Since then, poverty has increased, and we've been catching up to the national average. We're still a few percentage points below the national average, but 10, 20 years ago, we were much more than that. So poverty is also increasing in the state of Iowa as well.
Join our conversation on wealth distribution in this country, the trends we've been seeing in recent years. David Peters with us of Iowa State University, 1-866-780-9100. What do you think are the political repercussions, for instance, of the wealth distribution? Where do you see all this heading? 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on our Facebook page. Also joining us this hour, Nick Hanauer is with us. He's the author of In the Gardens of Democracy. Nick is an entrepreneur, a venture capitalist, and also an author of a special report that was in Politico magazine in 2014 with this title, The Pitchforks Are Coming for Us Plutocrats. Nick Hanauer, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
And we want to establish your credentials in our audience as, I don't know if a plutocrat, but a very well-off person. You write in your article that you're not only a 1%er, you are at the top end of that 1% in this country.
Yeah, but it is true, but I do want to clarify, I'm not a multi-billionaire.
You're not a multi-billionaire.
I'm not.
Okay,
I'm
well,
not.
You can...
We're hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and that puts you in the top 0.001%.
Okay, I understand you sold an internet company to Microsoft in 2007 for over $6 billion, but you owned it with others?
Yeah, it was a public company.
Okay.
And I was the first investor in Amazon.com, and I made an unbelievable amount of money in that. And I've either helped fund or finance 35 companies across a range of industries. So definitely tons of dough.
More than you can use in a lifetime.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Nick, thank you so much for coming on this because our producer, Lindsay Moon here, looked high and low, worked over months, getting at least one of Iowa's most wealthy people on this show, which I don't think they match your wealth. They all declined our invitation.
Yep.
In fact, the wealthiest person in Iowa is a man named Harry Stein, a net worth of $3 billion, according to Forbes. The brains behind Stein Seed, he made his money by selling genetic information for hybrid seeds to Monsanto in Syngenta. Okay, let's get to the meat of this. Now that we've established who you are, tell us, you've written about the fact that the pitchforks are coming for people like you. You say in your title, plutocrats. What's going on? What is your thinking?
Yeah, so I very much agree with Dr. Peters about the trends and the dynamics around around economic inequality and that the although the problem in a place like Iowa may not be as dire as it is in other places, the trajectory is bad and getting worse. In a society where a few people have everything and most people have nothing, bad things happen. It's bad for obviously bad for the economy, but it's bad for the democracy too. It's not that we have economic inequality. Some inequality is an essential element of a dynamic economy. The problem is growing and extreme inequality, which is what we are headed towards, and the thing that is so dangerous. But I do want to take a little bit of issue with the analysis Dr. Peters mentioned, and the sort of the traditional way of looking at it, which is the problem is low-skill jobs. This is simply not true. Our problem isn't that jobs are lower skill than they once were. Our problem is that that the power dynamics in our economy have shifted dramatically, and people simply are not paid as well as they once were. A barista at Starbucks is not less skilled today than an auto worker who worked at General Motors or Ford was in the 60s and 70s. The difference is the way in which those enterprises split up the value that they created. In the auto workers' case, they were fairly compensated, and they built decent and dignified middle class lives as a consequence. At Starbucks, the workers simply have no power. So the difference isn't in the skills. The difference is in the power. Economics is simply how human beings rationalize who gets what and why. It's how we instantiate our social and moral preferences about status, privileges, and power. And over the last 30 or 40 years, we have embraced this idiotic trickle-down idea that if the rich get richer, everyone will be better off. And it is simply not true. But we have instantiated those ideas into policy, which has impoverished the majority of Americans and enriched a tiny minority of us. And that is the source of the problem. And that's what's going to lead us into very bad territory.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the circles that you run in. You have conversations with other super rich friends of yours on this issue. What would we want to hear in those conversations if we were flies on the wall that we wouldn't hear normally in the press?
The conversation is changing. Like when I first started talking about this issue, economic inequality, 10 years ago, it made my peers extraordinarily uncomfortable and defensive. And today, people are willing to begin to acknowledge that this is a problem, and if the trend continues, it will be bad for everybody. As you must have discovered when you try to get people to talk about this on your radio show, it is a subject that makes rich people very, very uncomfortable, because the solution will involve trade-offs that lots of people don't want to make, at least in the near term. From my own view, I think that's extraordinarily short-sighted. No one has a stake in a thriving middle class as much as the people who build the businesses that depend on the demand that the middle class provides. So changing our policies to moderate economic inequality is, of course, is a thing that will benefit everybody. But, there are a lot of rich people who simply can't see beyond their narrow self-interest to get to an enlightened self-interest. And this is, of course, a you know, a great challenge.
It's interesting that you say this mindset and the change in the mindset. I had an experience many years ago, a moment of candor, once hearing an independently wealthy person I came across, not a super rich person, I don't think in your category, but someone who never needed to work. And this person, in talking about university jobs, these were faculty jobs at the university, this person remarked, "I really don't know how people get by on their salaries." Now, when you have that perspective, is it that people, peers that you have, how many of them are just deathly afraid of losing their wealth or of living like the rest of us?
You know, I think that one of the most corrosive parts about extreme inequality is the way in which the experience of extreme wealth and differential, it disconnects you sort of emotionally from the problems and challenges that ordinary people face. You know, like the ordinary concerns of 98% of Americans are things that I just don't share. You know, like the worry, the insecurity, the, you know, what happens if I lose my job? What happens if a kid gets sick? So on and so forth. And that builds distance and a lack of empathy. And I think that is very, very dangerous. And, you know, I'll give you this example. I mean, I'm not going to tell you where or who, but I was at an extraordinarily elite club recently, populated by people who can afford houses that sort of start at $5 million, and chatting with somebody I just met, and asked that person where they lived, and they proudly talked about this place that they had recently moved. Why? Because they didn't have to pay any tax there. Like, why did you move to this place? So I wouldn't have to pay tax. Not because I loved the place, because I thought it was beautiful, because I thought I could be an important part of the community. No, this is a person of extraordinary wealth, right? This is a person for whom taxes would make no difference in the course of their life.
So what do you think's going on there, Nick?
I just think it's the craziest, most sociopathic thing in the world. You just want to hit somebody like that in the head. Like, what the heck?
Right.
Like, if you don't pay tax, Who's gonna educate those children? Who's gonna build the roads? Like, what's your plan?
Right. So when you say the mindset is changing among your peers, your super rich peers,
wasn't changed clearly.
That person. Okay. We'll say that's a lost cause. But
yeah.
Among the people that you've seen a mindset change, what is it that changes their mind that convinces them that it really can't go on this way?
You know, I think it's simple math. I think that, you know, look, here's the thing. In 1980, the richest 1% of Americans shared about 8% of national income. 30 years later, 30 years after the Reagan Revolution, it's approaching 23-24%. It hit 24% in 2007. I think it's about there now. At the same time, the bottom 50% of Americans went from sharing about 18% of national income to about 11%. So if you just simply continue that trend for another 30 years, if you just assume that things will continue in the same way, then in another 30 years, the top 1% of Americans will share 35 or 40% of national income, and the bottom 50% of Americans will share 5 or 6% of national income. Well, that's not a capitalist economy anymore. That's a feudal economy. And that's an economy where people are going to be really super angry and
right.
Really super violent.
Let's get
what I mean about pitchforks, yep. Right?
Right.
This will be bad.
Right. Let's get our sociologist back into this conversation. Nick Hanauer is with us, a billionaire, entrepreneur, venture capitalist, author of In the Gardens of Democracy. David Peters, you're there in Ames. Associate Professor of Sociology. What do you hear? What do you think when you're listening to Nick Hanauer talk about the mindset of the ultra rich?
Yeah, it's very interesting. There was a recent study that came out in psychology a couple of weeks ago, and they looked at perceptions of philanthropy and attitudes towards taxation among wealthy individuals, and what they found was that self-made people that made their money, self-made individuals were much more likely to be more philanthropic with their money. They were much more likely to support more redistributive tax policies than those that had inherited their wealth, which is interesting. So we talk about, we've been talking about the super wealthy as sort of a monolithic whole, and I think that there are some distinctions between, particularly what these authors found, between those that inherit their wealth versus those that are self-made individuals with their wealth, that there might be some movement on that depending upon how people acquired that wealth.
Do you find that, Nick?
Totally. I mean, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, and my, you know, like my peer group, you know, they're mostly entrepreneurs. And, you know, the thing about us, you call it arrogance or confidence or whatever, but, you know, we have a high degree of certainty that we can continue to create wealth,
right?
Like we're really, you know, we feel like we're good at it. And so giving away money, being, you know, or paying taxes isn't something that we feel is an existential threat. But, you know, if your mom or dad made a pile of money and you inherited it and you have no skills, then every little bit that you give away, you're not going to get back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, there's a whole ton of people in this country that are wealthy mostly because their parents were, and they're just not super capable.
Right.
So they're very much in a preservation mode rather than feeling like they have the capacity to go out and, you know, fend for themselves.
Nick, you're going to stay with us in the second half hour, I hope. David Peters, sure. I know we're going to say goodbye to you at the half here. I want to give you a time to wrap up some loose ends and perhaps look into the future and see, are there remedies here? Do you share the concerns? How close are we to the pitchforks that Nick Hanauer mentions?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally that's correct. If the current trends continue, you're going to see a larger and larger share of that income being owned by the top individuals, and a winnowing of sort of that middle group of income and an expansion of that lower group of income. But you talk about the policy responses, and a lot of people have done some thinking about this, and they generally coalesce into three main areas. The first being that really inequality is irrelevant, that what we should be talking about is equity, not equality, that if people, as long as people are following the rules, they pay taxes, you prevent people from having a disproportionate influence on the political system, here I'm talking about the very wealthy, then there's nothing inherently wrong with that, that that's a free market economy, and that if people take risk, they should reap the rewards. That's one point of view. So the policy response would be nothing. Just make sure that existing rules are enforced.
Just about a minute left.
Oh, okay. Well, the other one says that we should be direct intervention in the economy like we did in the New Deal era and through most of the post-war period and through heavy taxes and redistribution of income. The third response, which is sort of the middle ground, is that it's opportunity that matters, that perhaps people don't care if they're several rungs below the ladder as long as everybody's moving up those rungs of the ladder.
That you have the ladders available to you.
That there's social mobility is perhaps maybe more important than trying to redistribute income because you keep a lot of the incentive structures still functioning.
Okay. David Peters, thank you very much for being with us. Associate Professor of Sociology at Iowa State University. Nick Hanauer is with us. We'll be staying with us in this second half hour. Author of In the Gardens of Democracy. He's an entrepreneur, venture capitalist, very concerned about our society, even though he has hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And we want to talk with him about what he calls the garden brain versus the machine brain when we come back. That's talked about in his book. Also, when we come back, we'll talk with Dave Anderson. He's at ISU, Assistant Professor of Political Science. Get into the political realm. What's that mean for politics? How is that being reflected in this election cycle? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Give us your comment, your question for a billionaire on our Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR Talk. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support comes from the...
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about wealth distribution in this country, all of those buzzwords and phrases that we've been hearing a lot about during this election cycle, the shrinking middle class, the growing divide between rich and poor, income inequality, discussing how that is playing out in terms of economics in our state, in our country. And also this half hour, I want to talk about the political ramifications we have. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, we'll be with us in just a moment, but we also have for the hour. Very grateful to have Nick Hanauer with us. He's the author of In the Gardens of Democracy. I'm holding the book right now. A nice little book that he wrote from the vantage point of a very concerned entrepreneur, a venture capitalist. He's a man worth now hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. He wrote in Politico magazine in 2014 an article titled, "The Pitchforks Are Coming for Us Plutocrats." Join our conversation. Your chance to ask a question of Nick or Dave Anderson, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. We do want to get to our phones and the other input in just a moment. Nick Hanauer, before the break, I wanted to have you very quickly, please, bring up the idea that you have in this book, The Gardens of Democracy, A New American Story of Citizenship, the Economy, and the Role of Government. You talk about the garden brain versus the machine brain. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, so very briefly, over the last 30, 40 years, there's been a revolution in our understanding of how complicated systems like economies and ecosystems actually operate, the math and physics of those things. And you know, again, to make a very long story short, you know, a modern understanding allows you to see that things are far more connected than we once believed, and that for instance, an economy isn't best understood as a sort of machine thing, a sort of a linear, mechanistic, stable thing. It's much better understood as basically as an ecosystem, as an evolutionary, dynamic, non-equilibrium system that is characterized by basically positive feedback loops. So what that tells you, for instance, is that prosperity, like you don't get prosperity trickling down from the top. You don't pour money like an ingredient into rich people and have prosperity pop out like donuts. It's really a consequence of a feedback loop between workers and consumers and businesses. So what that means really, for instance, is that prosperity doesn't trickle down from the top. It's built from the middle out, which is why a thriving middle class and the policies that support it, that's the foundation of growth. That's where economic growth comes from. A thriving middle class isn't the consequence of growth. And so that's the difference between sort of machine brain, which is really the trickle-down brain, and garden brain.
Dave Anderson is with us, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University, one of our political analysts, usually on Wednesday. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to this conversation. Tell us, in general terms, how has this conversation about inequality, this sometimes passionate conversation, many people concerned this time around about the wealth distribution in this country, how has it played out in this election?
Well, we hear candidates starting to talk about it now. If you go back to 2008 and 2012, we didn't hear many conversations about income inequality or wealth inequality. Some candidates talked about it, but it wasn't a centerpiece of their campaign. And this go-around, it has become the centerpiece of Bernie Sanders' campaign. And the Republican candidates are also talking about it. It's becoming an issue, and that's something new in America.
Mm-hmm. Also on the other side, can you account for the popularity of Donald Trump, the people who feel disenfranchised going that way?
Accounting for the popularity of Donald Trump would take a long time to talk about. But one of the things Donald did that I don't think many people talk about a lot is that in, I believe it was the first Republican debate, he was the only one on stage who said, you know, maybe we should close some tax loopholes for the wealthy. Maybe we should raise taxes for people like me. I'm a billionaire. I can afford it. And nobody else on stage was willing to say that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Set this in a little bit of a historical context, if you could, Dave Anderson. Have we seen this, what's going on now in terms of the distribution and the trends we're seeing toward inequality happen at similar points in recent U.S. history?
Yes. We've had a very similar trend that happened, I don't know if you'd call it recent, but during the 1920s, post-World War I, we had very high tax rates and very high government expenditures. And Calvin Coolidge came into office, Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge came in, and they cut tax rates across the board, and inequality almost immediately spiked. The last time we saw inequality like we have today was really in about 1929.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to Gary. Gary dialed 1-866-780-9100. Gary in Cumming, Iowa. Hi, Gary. What's on your mind as you listen to this conversation about wealth distribution in this country?
I love the conversation. I did have a question, and you kind of answered it just a while ago as I was listening. But if the pitchforks are coming, and I believe they are, in the form, if they're personified in the form of one Donald Trump and one Bernie Sanders, where do you think the middle class is leaning towards? I mean, are they leaning towards the Bernie Sanders camp that's calling for a political revolution? Or do you think it's the Don Trump camp that just says, you know, I'm going to take care of everything?
Okay. A good way to ask that question. Let's get our guests' views on that. Dave Anderson.
I think it's very split right now. And it largely divides on partisanship. If you were a Republican ahead of time, you go for Trump. If you were a Democrat ahead of time, you go for Bernie Sanders. And for independents right now, I think you're a little bit confused. Donald Trump has a lot of anger and passion that people like to hear, but some of his other stances aren't so popular. And Bernie Sanders says some things like that he's a democratic socialist, which scares a lot of Americans. And I think independents right now are very torn on which candidate to support.
Nick Hanauer, jump in here on the political end of things.
So I think that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are different sides of the same coin. Because there is no doubt that ordinary Americans have gotten the shaft over the last 30 years in this country, and Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are instantiations of the same kind of anger. So the people who support Donald Trump are blaming immigrants and people who do not look like them for their problems.
And an incompetent government, right?
Yeah, well,
I mean, that's Donald Trump's line, right? They're stupid.
But Bernie Sanders is saying the same thing.
Okay.
Right? But the people who support Bernie Sanders are blaming people like me, you know, crony capitalists and, you know, corporate types for the fact that they've gotten screwed. In both cases, by the way, it was government that was the instrument of changing the power dynamics, right?
Mm. Through deregulation, for instance.
Well, deregulation, depending on how – if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, or letting in the immigrants if you're a Trump supporter. And one of the – in my opinion – this sort of extremism is what you get when you don't take care of people, right? We are paying the price today in our politics for a set of policies that has made the lives of the typical family worse over the last 30 years rather than better. And that is why it's so dangerous. And the worse their lives get, the more extreme their politics will become, and the worse it will become for our country, for everybody.
Okay, let's continue this discussion. We're sadly running out of time. We have 10 or so minutes left with Nick Hanauer and Dave Anderson. Let's go back to our phones from Ely. Mark is calling. Hi, Mark.
Hi. So earlier you asked a question about why would a really, really wealthy person choose a community just because that community meant they wouldn't have to pay any taxes. And I think the answer to that lies in understanding a sort of mania that can happen to people, and that is hoarding. You see people on TV who have hoarded like old Dixie cups, and they fill up their homes full of hangers and paper bags, things that they will never probably need the rest of their life, and yet they keep piling it up higher and higher. And a billionaire is, I think, something akin to that. It's they have more money than they could ever spend on the finest restaurants. They could drive the finest cars, they could have the most wonderful home, and still never burn up all that money in their entire lifetime. Mm-hmm. The odd thing is, in our society, we really admire those billionaires. Oh my gosh, they've become so successful, they've got billions of dollars. And yet, it's really kind of a mania, very much like hoarding.
Mm, Mark, interesting observation. Nick Hanauer, you've come across many in among your peers, very, very rich people, you included. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the caller identifies something which is real, which is that some people are selfish hoarders. But, you know, like in my circle, like a lot of people didn't set out to be billionaires. We just, like, I just thought, oh, I want to transform this industry over here. And, you know, it worked out. And all of a sudden, I had a ton of dough. But, you know, I think that the deeper problem is that a person in a social situation can feel completely righteous in saying that the reason they moved to where they did was so that they didn't have to pay taxes and make a contribution to their community. And people don't, like, want to chuck them out a window, right? What's super interesting is that we have created a culture where saying that isn't shameful. That's the crazy thing to me.
Yeah.
That this is somehow righteous, that we should be proud of the fact that we're not making a contribution to our community, that we're not connected to it, the way in which we chose where we were going to live is on the basis of how little we got to contribute back into it. And that I find to be the most corrosive thing.
Here's a tweet from one of our listeners that perhaps goes to the heart of it, or close to the heart of it. Mohammed tweeting, "I'd like to know what pathways can the wealthiest pave to allow stronger alliances between the less privileged and the very rich." So let's talk about possible remedies, possible ways out in the final few minutes. What do you think about that, Nick? I mean, we do have a lot of very wealthy people with foundations doing great work all around the country and the world.
Absolutely. Not all rich people are bad people. Just like not all poor people are good people, right? But the heart of the problem, in my opinion, has been the way in which ordinary Americans, people living in Iowa, have been brainwashed by this whole trickle-down economics thing, this idea that if the rich get richer, everyone will be better off. A corollary of that, of course, is that if the poor get richer, it will be bad for everyone. This idiotic idea, for instance, that if you raise the minimum wage, it will kill jobs. There is no evidence for that. When workers have more money, businesses have more customers and need more workers. Raising the minimum wage isn't bad for growth. It's good for it. Trickle-down economics, these claims, that this is an intimidation tactic masquerading as economic theory. The only thing that's true about the claim that if the minimum wage goes up, it will kill jobs, is that if people like me can get people like your listeners to believe it's true, it will work out economically for me. And this is the thing we must change. People need to reject these idiotic claims and recognize that the better an ordinary family does, the better it will be for our country.
Dave Anderson, get in here. We have less than 10 minutes left in this conversation. When we talk, so what shift do you see politically taking place? We've for decades and decades, it's always talk about the growing economy. We've got to grow the economy. Not really talking about the growing of the middle class until more recently. A significant shift, you see.
Yes. We used to talk about it because we, as a country, I think, believed, we kind of bought into this rhetoric that as long as we grow the economy, everybody will do better.
We will share in the riches.
Rising tides lift all boats. And what we've seen over the last 30 years is it's just not true. The upper class has done very well. The middle class has stayed put. And if anything, maybe they've dropped a little, and the lower classes have dropped a little. And that means that our growing economy has not helped most Americans. And finally, people are looking around and realizing this, and that's the call for change.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting portion of an email from one of our listeners, Joan, that puts it in a global perspective. According to globalrichest.com, Joan writes, a person in the U.S. making $32,000 a year is in the top 1% globally. Can you comment on the extreme global poverty and how we can develop a global vision in our sense of the common good? Here we are feeling bad for the poorer people in the United States when Nick Hanauer, on a global scale, most people here are doing really well.
Yeah, I mean, this is, of course, true. And the global trends actually are very, very promising. I mean, market capitalism is a fantastic system if it's well constructed. And the rates of global poverty are falling like a rock. I mean, globally, people are much better off than they have ever been. But the most important thing I think for Americans to focus on is particularly given that America is to a great extent the engine of the global economy, the way to make sure that our economy is the best that it can be is to moderate the levels of economic inequality in our country. And I want to make this argument not on moral terms, right? Like, of course, a highly unequal society is an immoral society. But the bigger reason to mitigate, to moderate economic inequality is because it's good for growth. That, you know, the more money the ordinary worker makes, the better business is for everybody. You know, raising the minimum wage, for instance, to $12 nationally into 15 to places like Seattle, San Francisco, and these big cities, is the quickest way to inject dynamism into our national economy. It doesn't just benefit the workers; it benefits the businesses that serve those workers. And you know, Americans need to be united around calls to solve these collective action problems. And it is ridiculous that Republicans in Congress won't raise the minimum wage from the idiotic $7.25 it is nationally today.
Dave Anderson, give us a picture of where the presidential candidates stand on this. We have the Iowa caucuses in just a few days. We're assuming that to some degree or whatever degree, however they look at it through their particular prism, the candidates see and recognize wealth distribution as possibly a problem. It's certainly on the minds of many voters. How is it dealt with different in terms of solutions in the candidates on both sides of the aisle?
Well, three Democratic candidates, sorry, Martin, generally support rising minimum wages. They support higher taxes on the wealthy. And kind of a redistribution to collect more tax revenue, spend it on the poor and the middle class, and create more opportunity in America. And that's kind of where it stops, except for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the only candidate I know of in a generation who has argued that maybe we need to raise taxes on everybody and fundamentally redistribute wealth and reinvest big time in America through our government.
Right. How do you explain that? He's saying, I will tax you more, and he is been growing in popularity. There's been no politician who's done that for a long time.
You're right, in a long time. I think he's tapping into kind of a civic duty strain in America, where people used to believe that paying taxes was the cost of citizenship. It's what you do to say that, thank you, I'm a citizen, the American government is great, we can do great things together. And I think Bernie's tapping into this in a way that nobody's even tried in a generation.
Okay, what about on the Republican side? Quickly, what is the solution on the – or the explanation or the slash solution?
Unfortunately, all I'm hearing so far is tax cuts, that if we do further tax cuts, this will rise the tide and that will lift all boats, and that will be good enough.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the wealthy definition of plutocrat that you had in that article. Nick Hanauer was a person who derives power from their wealth. When we talk about the wealthy, we're talking about, well, the Koch brothers on the Republican side, but we also have those on the very wealthy supporting the Democratic side. Spent a lot of money on this election, a lot of conversation about the very wealthy buying elections since our Citizens United decision of 2010. I guess Jeb Bush wishes it was the case. What are your thoughts about the money influence on our elections, Nick Hanauer?
Yeah. I think that one of the most dangerous things about really high levels of economic inequality is that it inevitably leads to legal and political inequality, which in turn reinforces the economic inequality, right? And so, you know, this is the super dangerous thing, is that you know, if you allow, you know, a tiny minority of people to control with their money the political process, that political process in turn will help them control the economic process, which in turn enables them to control the political process. And this is why Citizens United and the associated rulings are such a catastrophe for a democracy. Now, by the way, money isn't everything, right? As Jeb Bush is finding out, and there are plenty of examples where you know, you can spend just a jillion dollars trying to affect a political process and fail. But on the margin, letting the richest people define the terms of the debate is you know, that's just not the way you should run a railroad, and it's extraordinarily unfortunate.
Less than a couple minutes here to finish off our conversation. I wanted to have you both finish off by looking forward. Dave Anderson, you first, please, in less than a minute. How do you see this – what are the scenarios? How could this
play itself out in this and future elections, this wealth distribution problem?
Well, if wealth distribution doesn't get reconciled soon, I think Nick is right. People are coming with pitchforks. And really, the threshold is when a majority of Americans look around and realize that they are worse off today than they were a generation ago, that's when they demand change. And honestly, they may just ask for the policies of a generation ago because they produced better outcomes.
Okay. Nick Hanauer, the last word to you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that people don't end up asking for policies. I think, you know, you get riots, and it gets very ugly.
But pitchforks is a symbol here. Don't we have mechanisms in this democracy, if it's a pressure cooker, to let off the pressure and to adjust somewhat so that the uprising doesn't come?
Those are available to us, and if we take them now, I think there's a good chance that we can head off the worst of circumstances. But you know, like, we need to act quickly, and we need to act decisively to enact policies that benefit a majority of Americans rather than a tiny minority at the tippy top.
Nick Hanauer, thank you so much for joining us, author of In the Gardens of Democracy, an entrepreneur, venture capitalist. Nick, thanks for joining us this hour. Dave Anderson. Thank you. Thank you. Dave Anderson with us of Iowa State University. Thank you, Dave. And we'll look for you on perhaps one of the next coming politics day. Thanks, Dave.
Glad to join in.
Okay. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Politics Day tomorrow at this time. We'll hope you tune in. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.